Spring has sprung, and big savings are in full bloom at Menards. Visit Menards Garden Center for everything you need to get your garden growing. Choose from hundreds of beautiful, colorful flowers, lush trees and shrubs, and everything in between. Menards Garden Center is back in bloom. Stop in today to get your garden on. Check out fresh deals happening now at Menards.
Save big money at Menards.
Spring has sprung, and big savings are in full bloom at Menards. Visit Menards Garden Center for everything you need to get your garden growing. Choose from hundreds of beautiful, colorful flowers, lush trees and shrubs, and everything in between. Menards Garden Center is back in bloom. Stop in today to get your garden on. Check out fresh deals happening now at Menards.
Save big money at Menards.
This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
The prosecution in this case has issued subpoenas to the FBI laboratory at Quantico, to the Ohio Bureau of Criminal Investigation, to Apple, to Verizon, to WhatsApp, to Meta, to Google, to Microsoft, to X, to YouTube, to Instagram, banks, insurance companies, software corporations. Nearly three dozen subpoenas in total, targeting individuals and institutions across the digital and financial landscape of Caleb Flynn's life. It's the digital footprint. It's not a case built on a refrigerator and a 911 call, just in case you're playing along at home. It's a case built on a map, a digital and financial reconstruction of who this man was, what he did, what he searched, what he spent, what he said, and who he said it to. Of course, he's innocent till proven guilty. Whatever the prosecution is preparing to present to a jury, it goes far beyond what happened inside 932 Cunningham Court in the early morning hours of February 16th. It goes into the months and possibly years before it. And the scope of that subpoena list tells you something the prosecution hasn't said out loud. They believe the evidence they need to prove this case exists and the digital footprints Caleb Flynn left behind is there. In his phone records, in his social media activity, in his financial transactions, in his insurance policies, in his communications through apps that promise privacy but still leave traces. They filed motions to compel Apple, Verizon, WhatsApp, and Meta to comply with court-ordered searches warrants served between February 19th and February 24th. The days immediately following the arrest, the fact that motions to compel were necessary means at least some of these companies pushed back or delayed. And the most recent hearing, six of the eight companies served with show cause motions have responded. Two have not. An April 23rd status conference will address the holdouts, meaning the full universe of evidence the jury will see may not be finalized until days before that trial actually begins. They're putting those pieces together right now. But let's back up and walk through what this case looks like structurally, because the indictment tells its own story. On March 18th, a Miami County grand jury returned an 11-count indictment against Caleb Flynn, one count of aggravated murder, three counts of murder, two counts of felonious assault, three counts of tampering with evidence, and two misdemeanor counts of intimidation of an attorney, victim, or witness in a criminal case. For listeners who aren't familiar with how Ohio law structures its murder charges, multiple counts of murder in a single case don't necessarily mean the prosecution is alleging multiple acts. They can reflect different legal theories for the same act. Aggravated murder in Ohio requires proof of prior calculation and design, essentially premeditation. The separate murder counts may reflect different theories: purposeful killing or killing committed during the commission of another felony. Each theory is a different path to the same destination, and the prosecution is laying down all of them. The three tampering charges align with the prosecution's core argument that the crime scene was staged. And the intimidation charges, which have not been publicly detailed, suggest that something happened after the arrest that the prosecution believes constitutes witness tampering or obstruction. Most likely, It was those several days those children were still in his custody. Those are the witnesses. If convicted on all counts, Caleb Flynn faces a life in prison without the possibility of parole. At his March 19th arraignment, he pled not guilty to every charge. His bond was raised to $3.5 million. Now the evidence the jury will weigh. Not all of it's public yet. Far from it, but the public tells a story of its own. You already know the physical scene from part one of this series, a 9mm handgun, the two shell casings, you know, the foot of the bed, Ashley in the master bedroom with two gunshot wounds to the head. Caleb's claim that he was sleeping in his daughter's room because of a cough and wasn't in the master bedroom, the open center console in the truck where he kept his handgun. The garage side door open but blocked by a refrigerator that, according to the affidavit, would have had to be pushed to open. Those are the physical building blocks, but the prosecution is clearly constructing something much larger. The BCI and FBI joined this case early. Subpoenas have been issued to individuals who worked on the case from both agencies, including personnel from the FBI lab at Quantico. The involvement of federal forensic resources in what is being prosecuted as a state-level case tells you something about the complexity of the evidence being analyzed here. You don't bring in the FBI lab at Quantico for a straightforward domestic case. You bring them in when there's digital forensics, ballistics analysis, and other specialized work that exceeds the capacity of local or state resources. Then there's the expert report that nearly derailed the trial timeline. On April 11th, the prosecution received a report from an expert in the case. They provided it to the defense the same day, but Ohio law requires that expert reports be disclosed no later than 21 days before trial. The original April 28th date was now inside that window. The prosecution then filed for a 4-day continuance. The defense objected forcefully. Attorney Emily Smith filed a motion arguing that the state was the sole decision maker on what to accept charges, on when to accept charges and when to indict the defendant. Consequently, starting the clock on the defendant's speedy trial rights. In other words, you picked this timeline and you didn't get extra time because you couldn't manage it. Judge Jeanine Pratt granted the continuance anyway. She noted that the speedy trial deadline wouldn't expire until early July, and the delay was minimal. For a murder case of this complexity, with FBI involvement and dozens of subpoenas pending, this is extraordinarily fast. If this trial still stays on track, for as of the day we're recording this, it is supposed to get underway May 4th of 2026. Now, again, that can change. The nature of that expert report, we don't know yet. Not publicly disclosed. We don't know if it's digital forensics, ballistics, blood spatter analysis, or something else entirely. What we know is that the prosecution considered it significant enough to risk the political cost of asking for a delay. And the defense considered it significant enough to fight. The defense side of this case has been strategically interesting to watch. Caleb Flynn is represented by L. Patrick Mulligan and Emily Smith, a well-known Dayton criminal defense team. Their pretrial maneuvering has followed a pattern: aggressive motions filed, then selectively withdrawn, created the impression of a defense team that is probing the prosecution's boundaries while keeping its own strategy hidden. The most visible example? The gag order attempt. In March, the defense filed a motion for a non-dissemination order that would have blocked the release of police reports, video, audio recordings, lab reports, written statements, or any other evidence or discovery until the case was fully resolved. They argued it was necessary to protect Flynn's right to a fair trial, citing evidence that had already been released and was shared online, garnering thousands of views and comments. The prosecution objected. Judge Pratt ordered all parties not to speak about the case pending the motion hearing. And then the April 10th hearing scheduled to argue the issue. Mulligan stood up and withdrew the motion. No explanation, no context, just, "It is our intention to withdraw the motion." When the judge asked if there were other motions to discuss, Mulligan said, "At this point, no. We haven't found anything worthwhile." 5 days later, on April 15th, the defense filed a motion for a jury view of the Flynn home. They want to walk jurors physically through 932 Cunningham Court and assess the ease of ingress and egress from said home. They're talking about the refrigerator in front of the door. It's a direct challenge to the prosecution staging theory. If the defense can show that the layout of the house, the doors, the garage, the refrigerator placement actually supports a possibility that someone could have entered outside, the prosecution's central narrative gets harder to sustain. A jury standing in that garage looking at that door and that refrigerator might see something that photographs and diagrams can't convey. But that's also assuming this case simply is based on could someone get in or out. That digital footprint that prosecutors have, that's where the story is. If there's a way to physically move that refrigerator by that door, there's your answer. Could someone have gotten in through that door? I do not know the answer to that question. But if there is a way to navigate that fridge, to move it, if you open that door and you move that fridge, if there's a way to do it just by having that door open, well, there you go. It's doable. That's not so much the question. It's why would someone want to go in and murder this woman? Then just disappear. Who has motive here? Who does not? It's not necessarily a question of a fridge being moved, although that's a big piece. I think more of this case is going to be answered in the actual digital evidence. The texts, the emails, the searches. And then there's a conflict of interest. At the April 6th status conference, Judge Pratt disclosed that she had recently hired a staff attorney who was a former employee of the Miami County Prosecutor's Office. That attorney had been employed at the prosecutor's office during the period this case was under investigation. Both the prosecution and the defense were given the opportunity to request a new judge. Both sides waived. Caleb Flynn personally waived his right to object under oath on the record. It's a calculated decision by the defense, keeping a judge they've been in front of rather than risking an unknown replacement. It also means that there's an appeal down the road. The conflict issue has been formally addressed and waived, which when you waive it, well, it's on the record. You waived it. Not super strong on appeal. And then came the moment that set the final trajectory of this case into motion. At the April 16th pretrial hearing, the last one supposedly before the trial, Judge Pratt asked Mulligan directly whether the defense had discussed a plea agreement. Mulligan said they hadn't. Prosecutor Paul Watkins stated the state's position plainly. The state's offer at this time would be to plead guilty as charged. Not a reduced charge, not a lesser sentence, not a negotiation. Plead guilty to everything, all 11 counts. It's not really an offer. It's a declaration. The prosecution is saying, we believe we can prove every single count and we're not giving you an inch. And the defense's answer was just as clear, no deal. Judge Pratt's response was three words, okay then, we're going to trial. Both sides walked into that courtroom and drew a line. The prosecution said, we'll prove it all. The defense said, go ahead and try. Neither side blinked. And now a jury will decide. What will you decide? They'll hear a 911 call. They'll see the body cam footage. They will learn about the refrigerator, the truck console, the shell casings, the garage door. They'll likely hear testimony from BCI agents and FBI lab technicians. They'll see whatever digital and financial evidence those dozens of subpoenas produce, the phone records, the social media activity, the financial transactions, the insurance policies, the communications that the prosecution has spent 2 months fighting to obtain. And if the defense's motion is granted, those jurors may walk through 932 Cunningham Court themselves. They may stand in the garage and look at the side door. They may walk through the master bedroom where Ashley was found. They may see the layout of the house and try to reconcile two competing stories. One where an intruder broke in and killed a sleeping woman, and one where the man who called 911 in an apartment, or rather in apparent anguish, was, according to prosecutors, the one who pulled the trigger and then staged the scene. The man in question appeared on American Idol 13 years ago, briefly, and told the world he loved his wife more than anything. He led congregations in worship across two states. He worked for his wife's family business. He was a father of two girls who were asleep in their beds when their mother was shot to death in the room down the hall. According to the prosecution, he is also the man who allegedly did that. Staged the scene to look like a burglary and called 911 pretending to be a victim. According to the defense, he's pleading not guilty to every charge and is ready for trial. They filed no motions challenging the evidence. They waived the right to object to the judge. They've rejected a plea, and they have asked the jury to come to the house to see it for themselves. That's the question the jury will answer. Ashley Flynn cannot. What happened there? She's been gone since February 16th, 8 days away from her 38th birthday. She's a teacher, a coach, a mother, a woman whose community raised over $175,000 for her daughters in the weeks after her death. Because even in grief, even in confusion, even in the middle of a case that nobody fully understands yet, the people of Tip City knew one thing for certain: two little girls needed protecting. And that part, at least, they didn't need a jury to decide. Where do you think this goes? Is this all as damning as it seems? Is he an American monster? Or is this a investigation that put on blinders from day one and said, you did this? And a defendant who is all too eager to defend himself in court with not a lot of time to plan in advance. There's a lot in this case. We'll examine it as the evidence comes out in court. I got to say this. Right now, from what we've seen, he looks pretty damn guilty, does he not? I mean, in my opinion, he does. But we haven't seen the evidence yet. What is the motive? What's going on here? What's in these digital files? What do we not know? Maybe it is pretty clear cut. But until we hear those things and know those things, it's really hard to judge completely. It's a lot that looks pretty bad here, without a doubt. But that's the picture that's been painted by the DA as of right now. There's another voice in this story, and it deserves to be heard before a decision is made. Again, give me your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. We'll continue the conversation there. Links are in the description. Until then, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.